And welcome to yet another Texas U.S. Senate candidate forum. The first question, what are your thoughts on the 800-pound gorilla who was not able to attend today's forum? We'll begin with you, sir. Okay, Mr. Leppard, anything you'd like to add?
Just another catfight. Well, I'm Tom Leppard, and this is the Texas Tribune Tribcast. I hate the career politicians and their seven-second sound bites, and you won't hear any of them here. Just a few reporters sounding smart and making sense. Take it away, guys.
Hello, and welcome to another Tribcast. Thanks, Mr. Leppard. I don't even understand what he did because it sounded like a compliment, and I don't think we're used to it.
I'm wishing Reese was back.
So, welcome again. You just heard from Executive Editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
I'm also here with editor of the Texas Tribune, Emily Ramshaw.
Hello there.
And not editor, Morgan Smith.
Hello.
I'm, of course, Ben Philpott from KUT and the Texas Tribune. I'm also not an editor. So this week we're going to talk about...
Thank God.
Yeah, there you go. Talk about a little redistricting.
We do have safety mechanisms around here.
A little bit on school testing and, of course, all the news around Susan G. Komen and abortions in general in Texas. A fun topic. We'll end with that one on an upbeat note. Why don't we just start real quickly? Let's get this out of the way. Do we know when the primary is yet, Ross?
Not yet. The San Antonio court is going to have a hearing next Wednesday. They haven't rejected the deal that the attorney general tried to reach with some of the redistricting parties. Not everybody signed off on that. There's still plenty of fighting about it, but the court could theoretically order a map in time for a primary in mid to late April. April 3rd is gone. They could still also, they've talked about a split primary, you know, with the presidential early and everything else later, they could still do that, and we'll know more on the day after Valentine's Day.
So talk me through the Malk versus MALDEF, you know, how the different sort of Hispanic, the Latino groups came down on this.
Well, they split. The two sort of lead Latino groups here are the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus. The lawyer for them and for some other people is Jose Garza, who's he's one of the wizards of redistricting. He's been around for a long time. He really knows this stuff. He knows the case law. He's the guy who argued the case on behalf of all the plaintiffs when it went to the Supreme Court. Nina Perales is the lead of litigation for MALDEF, and she's, you know, one of the other lawyers on that bench. There's like 15 people over there, but she and Jose are the two lawyers that everybody says those are really the horses here. So Nina's group, MALDEF, signed off on this, as did a couple of other groups that are with them. Jose Garza's group did not sign off on this. One of the differences here, and I don't know that it was the critical difference, it's kind of hard to see inside this, was that MALK is a bunch of legislators. MALDEF is a bunch of Latinos who are not legislators, so they have different interests to protect. MALK is protecting incumbents to some extent and protecting political interests to some extent. MALDEF's more in a position where they're protecting Latino interests and really don't care, in some cases, whether a district is Republican or Democratic as long as it's Latino. So there's some differences there, and they haven't been able to crack the to put together a deal that satisfies both groups.
Now, the NAACP did not sign off on these maps, right? Or did they?
Right. The NAACP did not sign off. They were pushing for what's called a coalition district, which is where you take a smaller than majority group of Hispanic voters and a smaller than majority group of African-American voters. You combine them so that those two groups together make a majority. The Supreme Court said you don't have to create those kinds of districts, and it kind of left them out on the plank. So NAACP has not signed off. The Legislative Black Caucus is not signed off, but not necessarily in opposition either. And the court basically didn't throw out the map. They didn't reject the map. They just said, doesn't look like y'all have a deal yet. Keep talking. We'll see you next week.
But is there a chance that you're going to get everyone to sign on to one map?
You're not going to get everyone to sign on to one map, but you may get a map, and you may actually have the map in hand. You may get a map that the court says, you know, look, this is what we're going to use for the elections. The state gave up four or five House seats here. They gave up two congressional seats here. The Senate district is drawn closer to what Wendy Davis's current district is than to what the legislature drew. The court may look at this and say, you know, not everybody's on board, but we have two judges on board, so we're going with this.
If you're a candidate right now, I mean, what kind of position are you in? What are you thinking? When do you want the elections held?
You're sitting under your desk in a fetal position. they can't raise money. Everybody's frozen. You know, some of the big PACs and some of the regular donors have said, you know, we're not going to give money to anybody until we know what the districts look like and what the competition looks like. If you're a candidate who's in a district that looks, you know, this way on one map and that way on another map, you're probably just going to campaign in the areas that overlap and hope for the best. And some candidates are frozen. You know, Jeannie Morrison, for example, a House member from Victoria, is a candidate on one map. On another map, there's no way to win and she won't be a candidate. So she's frozen.
She's been up in the air for a long time. I mean, the original stories we were writing about this a few months ago, she was, you know, the one person up in the air. So.
Well, she got tossed. She got put into a district that included Corpus Christi, where she's never campaigned. And more importantly, that paired her with Todd Hunter, who's another committee chairman in the House, and she didn't want to run against. So in that map, she's a no. In the legislature's map, they're not paired, and she's a yes. So she just needs to see where the court falls.
And closer to home here in Austin, we're either going to have a battle of two Democrats with Castro and Doggett, or we're not.
Well, it won't be Castro and Doggett.
It won't be at all.
No, because Charlie Gonzalez quit Congress, and so Castro's going to run in the Charlie Gonzalez district.
Okay, there you go.
The question in Travis County is whether Doggett is in a district that he can win that's basically drawn for a Democrat in Travis County, or whether he's in that district, or his house is in that district that goes from Hayes County all the way to Tarrant, and he has to move over and run in a district that goes all the way down to Bear County. It's, you know,
so
everybody's uncertain. Everybody's just up in the air.
And if it's a split primary, what's the second date?
The second date would probably be the first slide date is April 17th. You start to get into municipal elections, and so most of May disappears because you can't do all these things at the same time. So the next slide date is May 29th, and the next one after that is June 26th.
And have we seen Newt Gingrich lobbying for that April primary yet?
No, but, you know, in an alternative universe right now, early voting starts on Monday in Texas for the March 6th Super Tuesday primary, and, you know Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum and Ron Paul are all appearing today at a Rotary Club in San Angelo trying to get the Texas vote. They're all begging Rick Perry for his support. You know, I mean, you kind of think of what might have been here. Texas might have been in play in the presidential race.
Well, that would have been interesting. Two election cycles in a row that it actually would have mattered here.
Yeah, how about that?
Well, let's skip off with that, and we'll hopefully, I'm sure we'll check back in almost every week with you on that one. So get ready.
Yeah, anybody else getting tired of this story?
I'm getting tired of this story. So, you know, I want to cover elections.
Sorry, Ross.
Well, speaking of a tired story, school testing comes up a lot, and and honestly, I'm
it
not
does.
Sure.
Yeah. I'll just take it from there.
There you
then.
Go. Go. Please. Yeah,
nice segue.
Yeah.
Well, right, I'm done.
Did Reeve leave you notes?
That stutter incoherently and then look at Morgan.
Oh, please. Reeve is sitting by the pool with a bunch of folk musicians.
Right, there. Right. They're all wearing shorts and vests.
Hopefully getting me an autograph from Lucinda Williams.
Oh, there you go.
I hope he's listening.
So, well, this has been a storm that has been brewing for a while. The state is rolling out its new STAR exams, which is a student assessment system, the standardized tests that students take, and school districts' accountability ratings are based largely on students' performance on these tests. So they're fairly high stakes. And this year, for the first time, ninth graders taking the test, their final grades and their courses are going to be based on their performance on the test. And there's several graduation requirements that are linked to them. So that automatically means that parents are paying a lot closer attention. And it kind of comes as school districts are having a lot of anxiety about the budget cuts. So we kind of had all of these factors in play. But then last week, the Commissioner of Education, in kind of a big speech that was in front of 4,000 school administrators, came out and just said, you know, our testing system has gone too far. He said, you know, he still supports standardized testing. He thinks it has a role to play. But he said in fairly strong language that he has a lot of concerns about the way that this implementation is going.
Does he have concerns with implementation, or that the state didn't, and maybe this is part of implementation, that the state didn't secure enough money to help kids graduate or help kids pass this test, this new test?
Well, that's what he said. I mean, he said that he would not certify social promotion rules, which means that he would not, the ban on social promotion. So he would not say that, you know, we can't just promote these kids even without passing the test unless the state allocated more money to remedial tutoring. And that kind of had some lawmakers scratching their heads because they said, wait, you were in front of our committees testifying all session that you had enough money to make this work. Yeah,
what happened here? Did he take a pill? And the other question I have, you know, Robert Scott's very close to the governor. He was his on-staff education guy before he was TEA commissioner. Is this a change in the governor's position, too?
I don't think
we know. Not based on Monday night. Yeah.
I mean, you know, one thing to note about that day that Robert Scott made those comments is it was the same day that Tom Cease was speaking down the hall at the convention center to a different group, and Tom Cease was talking about, you know, how big of a hole the state is in with Medicaid. You can imagine, like, Perry sitting in his office with his head about to explode. It was like, you know, rogue appointee day.
Well, and both of these guys are close. I mean, your Health and Human Services Commissioner is out there saying $15 to $17 billion hole there. Your education guy is saying, you know, all that stuff about accountability in schools, never mind that. What's going on?
I mean, I think with Robert Scott, at least, he's been on being pulled in many, many different directions. And I think that even, you know, among in the legislature, you have the House, which is very much on a different page than the Senate on all of this. And you have Florence Shapiro, who is kind of the leader in the Senate, saying we have to go forward with all of this. We can't compromise on any of these requirements. She's not coming back next year. And so you kind of have the education, I guess the political power of the education leaders in the legislature shifting, then you have all of these parents, all of these superintendents just, I think, really, really concerned about how things are going to go. And you have, you know, Robert Scott finally, you know, speaking out and, you know, making some waves.
It's funny that, you know, we heard from all these teachers during the legislature, you know, all these folks who were really terrified that they might lose their jobs, but it may actually take the parent lobby to get the legislature to listen really closely. You know, once parents start getting nervous that their kids aren't going to graduate or their kids might not be able, you know, getting into college, then all of a sudden you hear from everybody. I mean, in a way you didn't necessarily hear from them as loudly when it was just that, you know, budgets were...
The attorney general tried to reach with some of the redistricting parties. Not everybody signed off on that. There's still plenty of fighting about it. But the court could theoretically order a map in time for a primary in mid to late April. April 3rd is gone. They could still also, they've talked about a split primary, you know, with the presidential early and everything else later. But I am curious about this. You know, so if Perry's not wanting to do this, or our sense is that, you know, Robert Scott and Perry are split on this, how does this play out? What are the...
I mean,
this is your redistricting story.
Right, I know. I mean, I think we're going to have to... I mean, we're going to have to see. I don't... Robert Scott hasn't publicly kind of walked back any of his remarks yet. Senator Shapiro has asked for an explanation. We haven't seen that. But then I just keep coming back to kind of the counterweight in the House. You have, you know, Rob Eisler, Jimmy Don Acock, Scott Hochberg to some extent, who are all kind of on the commissioner's side of this. So it's going to be a pretty interesting, I think, political battle to see what happens.
When all these lawmakers come out and say, I don't understand, last session you told us you had plenty of money. It's such a shock to me, because didn't we all know that we were cutting the budget so the governor could run for president? I mean...
Well, I don't know that we knew that we were cutting it so he could run for president, but we knew we were cutting the budget.
We knew we were cutting the budget. And I think the commissioners knew their role. The role was to come up and say, well, here's what we certainly hope we can do with the cuts you're going to give us. Saying, no, this is ridiculous wasn't going to work.
Well, the Cease and Scott things do look like the kinds of things you would not say while you're... governor mentor was running for president that they can now say. But
now,
I mean,
yeah, now they breathe the big sigh of relief and they get to get everything
right. Okay,
chest.
now we can talk.
Right.
So anybody outside other than Bill Hammond and the Texas Association of Business weighed in on this yet? They came in
Hammond cheerleader. Hammond said, "Keep going. We want testing."
Well, Hammond called Scott a cheerleader for mediocrity.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right? Well, you have kind of all of the business-oriented education groups that are on the side of moving forward. You have Shapiro, of course. But then you have all of the superintendents in the state, you have all of the teachers, you have the parents, you have, and then most of the lawmakers in the House. I mean, during the session, Eisler had a bill that would, that was changing some of these requirements. It passed overwhelmingly in the House.
Oh, including that 15% towards your final grade in a course?
Exactly.
They actually had,
yeah.
They had a committee hearing that I guess Morgan and I were both at a couple weeks ago where, I'm going to forget his name, former whip in the Democrat,
Jim Dunham.
Jim Dunham,
yeah.
Came up and said, look, my ninth grade daughter got her first semester report card, and she doesn't have a grade in three of her classes, and she doesn't have a GPA. And the reason is she's in ninth grade. She'll be taking STAR in the spring, and they have to wait until they have that 15% to figure out what her GPA is. And so he said, based on the way it's set up now, he might know sometime in August what her, or July, what her GPA is for her freshman year.
I don't know that you've looked at this, but how hard is this test?
It's actually pretty hard. Yeah.
I know I'm throwing you on the spot.
I don't know that I could do some of the math questions.
No,
this isn't one of those tests where you look at it and it's like, you know, finish drawing the circle
My wife is a testing director for a school district, for the Hays County School District, and she showed me, she's got a wonderful PowerPoint that shows the evolution of standardized testing.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And
yeah.
It's, you know, the first one, whatever it was, the question was essentially, you know, blank plus blank equals, you know. Then the next year, it was a two-step problem. You had to do two different things to get it. We're now at eight-step problems.
Like that's quadratic equations without a calculator.
You have to, different steps to come up with that final answer. And the PowerPoint's wonderful and scary.
Yeah.
Well, wow. From one firestorm to another.
Oh, that was a better transition.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's see how it goes. He's still in the middle of it.
From one firestorm to another.
Let's talk about abortion.
Good, that was great. Perfect.
So, Susan G. Komen had a little issue this week or last week.
Yeah, it's sort of an ongoing issue.
And it also came at a time when we had a few other things happen in the state in terms of the state's own policies on abortion. But
yes.
I guess
some people have Shark Week. We have Abortion Week.
Nice.
Thanks. All right. So the latest is that first of all, on the state level, the Department of State Health Services finally released this week all of their sort of guidelines and rules for enforcing the abortion sonogram law. What that means is that basically abortion clinics, family planning clinics across the state now will have sort of some semblance of how these laws have been, this bill has been interpreted and how they're supposed to proceed. So basically the department said, you know, we're going to start enforcing this now. We're releasing these rules on Monday. By Tuesday, basically, you better be doing this because they are going to be in their inspections gauging to see whether abortion clinics are providing these sonograms at least 24 hours ahead of the abortion and also describing the fetus, playing the fetal heartbeat aloud, showing the woman the image unless she requests not to see the image. So they're pretty specific now, these rules that have been in effect for a while. The other thing that happened from a legal standpoint is that the Austin judge who originally said that the part of the sonogram procedure, the playing the fetal heartbeat and showing the image, that part, you know, might be unconstitutional. He called for a restraining order originally. A federal appeals court said, you know, no, thank you. This provision has to be enforced immediately. And he's now backed down on that provision, on that restraining order, basically saying, you know, OK, I'm not going to win this part of it.
The law is the law. This is Sam Sparks, the federal judge.
Yes.
Right?
Yep. So that's the sort of where the legal side of this. There is
Does it
still,
go forward? I mean, is
there is
there
a pending suit against over the constitutionality of the sonogram law, of a certain provision of the sonogram law, the most controversial, which is, you know, requiring the woman to hear the heartbeat and look at the image. But that lawsuit is a while from being decided. So in the meantime, clinics are required to follow through with this. The fascinating thing is that these clinics say, you know, that isn't actually the toughest part of the law. The toughest part of the law is this 24-hour rule. And no one's really refuting the 24-hour rule. So,
and that's a scheduling thing. It's a money thing.
Just, it's a scheduling and sort of bureaucracy mess for these clinics because there aren't that many abortion doctors in the state. And these doctors already, you know, jump from clinic to clinic depending on the day of the week. And so if the same doctor has to perform your sonogram and perform your abortion, that means that doctor now has to be at that same clinic 2 days apart as opposed to transferring between one clinic and the other clinic.
Well, and there have also been people people have come out and said, you know, if you're down in the valley, you have to drive 3 hours away.
Now, those women,
you may have to spend the night overnight now.
Right. But those women have a special exception. There's actually, apparently, there's only one district where you can be more than 100 miles from an abortion clinic. And in that district, in that case, you get an exception. It's a 2-hour rule as opposed to a 24-hour rule. But there are not that many women who would be affected by that carve out.
You have to have this test within 24 hours or at least 24 hours before.
At least 24 hours before.
Okay, so there's a time lag built in.
And so what the abortion clinics say is, you know, this is a big inconvenience, not just for us, but for the women. Women come in with their minds made up. You know, nobody's changing their mind over the fact that they now have 24 hours. You know, the opponents of abortion say, look, pretty much in any medical procedure, you wouldn't go in and have, you know, your sonogram or your x-ray done, you know, that same day and then have the surgery 2 hours later. You know, I think that could probably be debated. If you break your leg badly and you go in and get an x-ray, you get surgery.
Yep, sure is broken. We'll see you tomorrow.
About that car wreck. We'll see you tomorrow.
Right. My question is going to be, do we have any idea if, you know, seeing the sonogram, hearing the heartbeat, does that persuade women not to have an abortion? Do we have any idea? Is there any research out there?
You know, I asked that question both to abortion opponents, you know, the organizations, but also to some crisis pregnancy clinics. And both of them said, you know, well, no, we don't have any evidence of that. You know, but the crisis pregnancy centers say often it's not just seeing the image, it's us being there and telling them, you know, you have an option, we will help you, you know, we'll be here with you, we'll be holding your hand, you know, we'll provide diapers. You know,
or we'll
I think
help with an adoption.
Right, or we'll help with an adoption, right? Yeah, right. Better not help with the abortion. You know, I think obviously the on the other end of that spectrum is, you know, who helps you when you need to put that kid through college or who helps you down the road. So
I assume there was some conversation along the way about the 24-hour thing. I'm curious if there was any testimony or a conversation about, are you trying to make this an inconvenience in order, you know, if you're trying to slow down or stop abortions, an inconvenience plays for your side. I mean, is that what, did anybody sort of directly address?
You know, they wouldn't cop to doing it because it was an inconvenience. You know, they said we're doing this because we want women to have all the facts. You know, we want them to know exactly what's going on inside their body before they decide it. You know, the abortion clinics would turn around and argue, basically all you're doing is delaying this abortion. So, you know, in the scheme of things, if you're delaying the abortion 24 or 48 hours, that fetus is 24 or 48 hours older than it was, you know, when this woman originally wanted to have this procedure done.
Right. I just wonder if there's some thought that by complicating this that they reduce the number of abortions.
Right. You know, that's the question. If women can't get back to the clinic, if they don't have childcare, if they don't, you know, I think the abortion providers I talked to said, you know, it hasn't, women will go to great lengths to get an abortion if they need one, you know, they'll, you know, bring their families with them because they can't get childcare or they'll, you know, find the gas money to get there. So, you know, I think, so that's this firestorm at home over, you know, the state, Texas, and an abortion sonogram. You know, the other big Texas-based story that has made huge national news is this Komen stuff. And Komen is a pretty fascinating case because it has a lot of really close links to Texas, things that we've been watching. Nancy Brinker, whose sister, Susan Komen, was the one who died of breast cancer, and the Komen Foundation was started in her honor. Brinker is based in Dallas. You know, Komen and all of its sort of legs are based in Dallas. You also have Cecile Richards, the president of Planned Parenthood, on the other side of this battle. Cecile Richards is in New York now, but she was born in Waco. She is famously the daughter of Ann Richards. You know, the very first, she's been politically involved for years, the very first campaign she worked on was actually Sarah Weddington's campaign. Hmm. And Weddington was the lawyer in Roe v. Wade, the youngest person ever to win a Supreme Court case. So, you know, they're
like an HBO show.
Seriously. I mean, or like The Wire. You can draw this massive tangled web on the wall. And you also have the board chair of Planned Parenthood is also a Texan, also a prominent Dallasite, Guthrie Boone. Cecilia Guthrie Boone is her name. So, you know, and like the first group, the first couple of people to jump to Planned Parenthood's defense after Komen first, you know, retracted their support was a Dallas-based couple. I mean, it's really interesting. Almost all layers of this, you have key...
go back to Texas.
Yeah, key Texas people. Huh. So... the latest news was this from this week is that the vice president, the policy director, basically, who was they've sort of credited with being the leader of this decision to stop funding for Planned Parenthood has resigned. So,
She was running for office in Georgia and ran on an anti-abortion platform. Yep.
Well, and in resigning, she said that the move toward this, that the move toward this policy had begun before she was on board, and that, you know, while she was certainly in favor of it, she wasn't the sole motivator inside the organization.
Right, and the policy is, if you haven't already read it somewhere a dozen times, the policy is that they're not going to give funding to an organization that is under investigation. Well, there's an anti-abortion lawmaker in the U.S. Congress who has called an investigation of Planned Parenthood.
For an inquiry.
Inquiry. Right. And so that, according to the board at the moment, was enough to disqualify Planned Parenthood. They immediately came out, despite saying that it wasn't a political issue, they immediately came out and said, by the way, next time we do this, we're very sorry, we're changing the rule so that we cannot use politics within this, even though this was not a political decision.
Well, the politics of this thing are a mess. I mean, the Komen Foundation, by weighing in the first time, took a political position and made half the world mad, and then by reversing themselves, took a political position, made the other half mad, and, they got a lot of sorting out to do.
Yeah, I mean, is this something that we think they're going to be able to bounce back from, PR-wise?
Yeah, I mean, I think PR-wise, this is going to be a challenge, although we all know that memories are relatively short. I think what is going to end up being a big issue here is that people are going to really start closely looking at these giant quote-unquote charitable organizations. I mean, I think you've already seen these media reports have started looking into Komen's finances, for example, right. Looking at all the money they make versus all the versus the amount of money they spend on research, looking into the private jets that, Nancy Brinker takes all over the place. There's been sort of stories leaking out about how many high-level people have left that organization, over squabbles over the appropriate use of, funds. Right. I mean, I think you're going to
From both sides is throwing bricks now.
Right, exactly. I think you're going to see a lot of in-depth look at this sort of commercialization of pink, and I think that is something that could be hurtful to them if, they start having fundraising problems because people are questioning where their money is gone, right. In addition to who they're giving or not giving
to. The color pink may be back in the public domain.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
We won't have to pay an extra 25 cents every time I buy a shirt for my girls. I think that'll do it for this week. I mean, do we want to talk a little bit about Perry's first speech? I know.
Oh, why don't you? You were there. Tell us.
You brought it up.
Yeah.
So let me just say first of all,
right? Some other stuff we're not going to talk about.
In case you haven't seen this, I left as soon as his speech was over, as did Perry. He left the building as well. And once Perry was out of the building, though, they had a George Washington impersonator who stood up and told a joke. Have you heard the joke yet?
We've heard the joke. But go ahead. Tell.
The joke is a Muslim, a communist, and an illegal alien walk into a tavern, because it's a George Washington impersonator. And the tavern keep says, "What would you like to drink, Mr. President?" President Obama.
Bada boom.
Bada boom.
So tell us about happened before that.
The speech was essentially essentially four parts.
It's hard telling jokes without an audience, isn't it?
Or without them being funny. Speech was four parts. First part was him thanking individual people throughout the entire audience. Hey, Bob. Hey, Sally. Hey, Mike. All soldiers. And, of course, his wife. Then he talked for just a couple minutes about the fact that he lost, and that was it. He did not dwell on it at all during the speech. He said, Aggies don't like to lose, so we always say that we just ran out of time, and that if we had more time, we would have caught up, and so that's what he said. And then he talked about how he still had energy left.
Primary's not until June 26th.
They were both on Fox News, I guess, earlier that day, Perry
right.
and Anita.
Saying it would always, yeah. they would do it all over again. And so right. he said, look, I'm not fading off into the sunset. I've got a lot of energy left. And here are the things we got to do in the next legislative session. He talked about not raising taxes at all. He talked about how schools don't need more money. And then he talked about the need for the state to have a comprehensive water plan, which I believe does have a bill attached to it.
The last bill that was attached to that was $11 billion.
Yes. So I don't know where that money will come from. I'm sure we'll find out as we get closer to the legislative session.
How about the rainy day fund?
That's going to be gone paying for Medicaid.
check your other pocket.
the back pocket.
Right.
And then the last part of the speech, and I guess maybe closer to the last third of the speech, was just attacking the federal government, attacking President Obama.
It sounded like very similar to his, you know, stump speeches on the trail. Almost
he
to
ended
the
his
word.
Stump. Yeah, I mean, he ended.
I'm going to do everything to make Washington as irrelevant,
inconsequential
in your life as I possibly can. Which is
what he said all the time on the stump, and that's the way he ended it. So, you know, in the story I wrote, I said, I guess actually I tweeted, this sounds like a presidential campaign. Get your Perry 2016 hashtags ready.
What Anita said. She was hoping, you know, I think that we could run again.
So is Perry a speaker at the national convention? Does he get to play? Or do the other candidates come back to him and say, you know,
he's good with the teleprompter?
I think Perry wants to. I think Perry would love to speak at the national convention.
He's the Republican speaker at the Gridiron Dinner, which is sort of the Washington insidery funny, you know, he's like sort of the funny comedy speaker for the Republicans that night, which I think is going to be really, you know, clearly.
If only he had something to make fun of.
I know, exactly. He'll probably be great in that forum.
Yeah.
You know, poking fun at himself and telling some, you know.
Well, he was good on David Letterman. I mean, you know,
hamming it up.
There are second acts in Texas politics, and third acts,
and third acts. It would have been interesting to see. I mean, that speech very much sounded like I'm ready to get back to work as governor, and I'm thinking about running for president. And of course, a lot of people have said, well, if he's going to stay relevant, he has to run for governor again. So before he then runs for president, so we'll see how Greg Abbott likes that.
If he's a national figure, he doesn't have to run for governor again. A national figure, everybody has to pay attention in Texas. I mean, the lobby still has a guy in front of him who's got all those vetoes and all of those appointments. You know, he's not as lame a duck as, you know, Florence Shapiro, for example.
Well, why don't we just end on making fun of Florence Shapiro? Okay. So, if you have any questions or comments about the TribCast, please email us at tribcast@texastribune.org. On behalf of Ross and Emily, and Morgan and Todd, our great producer, I'm Ben Philpott, and we'll talk to you next week.
What are you smoking, a pipe there, Todd?
It's mate.
What the hell is that?
So it's a gourd, and the mate is
No.
In leaf form in the bottom.
I will listen to no sentence following the word gourd. You lost me permanently at gourd.